Hi, everybody. Welcome to Conversations with Calvin, We the Species. Chronologically, by the way, it's December 1st. This is December 1st. It's hard for me to process that in a few weeks it's Christmas and New Year's, then January and doldrums and snow and cold. And then it's May and it's Memorial Day weekend. That's how fast things fly along. This is such a special interview with Daniel Pezzetta. I'm going to call him Dan. It's special in so many different ways. And first of all, I'm going to tell you the title of this interview: Rare Diseases Legislative Advocate, Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases Intern. He's an author and attends George Washington University. I got that right, correct?
Yep.
and I got to thank, we were just talking about this before we went on air. I want to thank Yashi, last initial S, because Yashi and I met a few weeks ago. She was part of a panel discussion about One Health. She's an honor student at the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University. And this was kind of a scientific panel, but Yashi had the wherewithal and the vision, actually, she spent time with Dan at a camp and interacted with him, and she just thought Dan would be a great guest because of his place in the world. Would be a great guest for this. And it was Yashi's note to me, and I followed right up. And Dan and I, we kind of Zoomed a week ago just to kind of get acquainted. And here we are. And I always like to think of myself as worldly and well-read and so forth. But where Dan is and what Dan's involved in, and Every Life Foundation, which is a nonprofit that deals with rare diseases. I was a pharmacist, so I knew about big pharma and orphan drugs and all this kind of stuff. But point being, I just didn't know anything about rare diseases, and that's what we're going to talk about today. The other quick thing, rare diseases, there's 30 million people here in America who have a rare disease. And as I said to Dan before he went on air, that doesn't sound rare to me. That's a lot of people. That's almost 1 out of 10, 1 out of 11 Americans. That's a lot. So we're going to digest and talk about, and I've done my lengthy monologue, but it was important to set this all up. So, let me introduce Dan Pezzetta, and if you want to do a little background, a little bio, please do, and then we'll jump into some really interesting.
Yeah, you did a great job introducing me. So, as you mentioned, I go to George Washington University. I'm currently 23 years old. I was born with a rare disease. My condition is aortic stenosis. Funnily enough, it is the most common disease that elderly people develop in their 60s or 70s in terms of heart diseases, but to be born with it is incredibly rare. I've had multiple heart surgeries to deal with the conditions. My most common conditions would be fatigue, tiredness, hypertension. There's a lot of different things that I go through. And throughout my time in college, I was able to find a really amazing rare disease community, and I was able to become active in policy and active in advocating and helping other people become an advocate for not only in the policy sector, but for themselves.
Okay. That's a wow. And we'll talk a little bit more about, you know, you and that condition. You do work, and I pulled this off of LinkedIn. You do work as a legislative advocate for those with rare diseases. So what does that entail? I mean, you're a young guy. What does that entail to do this kind of work?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different aspects in terms of it. It's both knowing the policy and how to teach people to be confident in themselves to advocate. So it goes into the idea of researching the policies that are beneficial to the general community as a whole, being able to see which people in the House or Senate would potentially support these bills, trying to see how we can make new approaches to help people, either those Senate or House members that do support it, get other people on board, or ourselves making those initiatives to get people to support it and get on board. And once we really are able to target and focus on that, we're able to go to our advocates and people that have these lived experiences that need these bills passed to help their lives. We teach them how to public speak confidently, how to work on their elevator pitch, how to approach Senate or House members that may not support it, and ways that we can talk to them and share their our story and the benefits of the bill. So it's a lot of knowing the policy, but also helping put these people in a position to succeed and feel confident when they are advocating and actually make that difference.
Okay. What I like to do next is dissect the institution of rare diseases, as I did some of my due diligence as a journalist and explored every life. I saw some graphics which completely blew me away. So if we can go down these things one at a time, I said this in the beginning, your comments, it's not quote rare. 30 million Americans live with rare diseases. What would you want to?
Yes. I think it's interesting that that's kind of the idea, because like, all of us have all different conditions. I met so many people with so many different conditions, different types of disabilities, and regardless of that disability or the rare disease that people have, there's always that common like understanding of each other, that idea of like we've had very similar experiences despite different conditions. It's kind of the same issues with doctors, issues with family members, the benefits that these bills can help bring forward. So in both like a societal and a legislative aspect, there's a lot of mutual benefit that we have from each other, even though we have somewhat different experiences as overall.
Okay. This just blew me away. I said this before we went on air also. The economic cost of 379 rare diseases, the economic cost of that, just 379, is about $1 trillion. This was from 2019. Comment on that. I mean, I can't process that.
Yeah, having a rare disease is incredibly costly. The medications, treatments, not only on the expenses of that medical side, but also costly for families, surgeries, insurance, not covering everything, a lot of out-of-pocket costs, especially with the upcoming pandemic, it was very costly to try and find those treatments in a safe manner, or economically as well for those people. A lot of people with conditions, a lot of people with rare diseases aren't able to get the level of jobs that they want to have, or job opportunities that are equitable. So they're not able to make as much money. They have to rely a lot on other resources. A lot of people still live family members because it's just cheaper overall. They can't afford their own housing.
Wow.
So overall, it's very costly to be disabled and have a rare disease.
Wow. Public assistance. I mean, the whole package, it's so beyond. This also blows me away. I mean, all of these little bullet points blow me away. And again, I did come from the, as a pharmacist, I came from that sphere. But it takes 6.3 years to get diagnosed, a confirmed diagnosis with a rare disease, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And I can speak from my own personal experience right now, because I'm currently going through the process of trying to get something diagnosed. I currently have a second condition that is currently, they know that it's something, but they don't know exactly what it is. After about a year, we've determined that it is not another cardiac condition. So that's good. But now it's trying to figure out what exactly it is. And that's something where I'm thankful in a position where I have doctors and a support system that does believe my symptoms and conditions. Whereas a lot of other people, it adds that time because either doctors don't believe them for a multitude of reasons, whether it's age, weight, gender, whatever have you. There's a lot of factors where doctors just won't believe you. Race, another issue, for example, sexual orientation, a lot of different things. having family members believe you, that medical gaslighting, for example, it's something that is so hard and such a thing that so many people in the rare disease community have faced, because it's that idea of the doctors aren't believing you, your family members aren't believing you, your friends are not believing, your coworkers are not believing you, and you start doubting if your conditions are even real, if you're thinking about, like you think you're overthinking them or you're overplaying them. And it becomes a really hard challenge to face, especially when you are trying to find something that is undiagnosed.
Oof. Wow. I mean, 6.3 years. You know, it's interesting. Not interesting, interesting. But years ago, I had some cardiac things going on with me, and it took several years for them to figure out I had AFib. And I had bounced around from one doctor to another until I finally found this most amazing doctor. We'd become friends, and he did all the right moves. But it was literally a couple of years to diagnose my AFib. And, you know, it should be pretty easy. And now it's interesting. I'm looking, and modern technology, this is a portable EKG. I don't know if you ever saw that.
No, I never have.
No, it's called Cardia. I'm not doing a commercial for them. It's called Cardia, and you put your fingers on that, and it spits out an EKG in 30 seconds.
Huh.
Yeah, on my iPad. Like $70 on Amazon. So now, if I think I'm in AFib, you feel it. You feel it, I feel it. You know, I put my fingers up there and it says normal sinus rhythm or not. And it's been a wonderful adjunct for me. Such a simple thing. But anyway, so I understand, you know, the 6 points, 3 years, because it took several years until I found the right cardiologist.
Yeah.
To diagnose me. And some of the doctors before my present cardiologist, you know, said this, and maybe it's that, and actually one cardiologist never even did a blood test, so it kind of boggled my mind. So I kind of understand a little bit.
No, yeah, and it's hard having that uncertainty. I think the uncertainty is always the hardest part, where you know something is wrong with your body, but you don't know what it is. And yeah, that fear of, if there's something going wrong, is it going to get worse? Is it going to affect my quality of life? Is it going to be costly once they do find out, trying to get all the treatments and play catch up? Like, there's a lot of challenges, yeah, that also deal with that time frame as well.
Yeah. I know just what you're saying, Dan. Yeah. This was another interesting... 93% to 95%, and there are more than 7,000 known rare diseases. Out of that, 93% to 95% of those 7,000, there is no United States FDA approved therapy. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, even with a lot of incentives that our government has tried to put forward to have rare diseases, orphan drugs pushed and to be created. One example, PDUFA, Prescription Drug User Fee Act, gives a lot of incentive in terms of investing and studying and developing orphan drugs. There's just the biggest problem that always comes forward is that if you're creating a drug and spending all this money doing the research and creating it, and there's only, say, a condition with 300 people, it's just not profitable. And that's the unfortunate reality. It's not a common cancer. It's not a common, and not something common like diabetes. It's some condition that only 4 or 5 doctors in the country know about and specialize in. And that's something that is incredibly difficult to try and say, as our small communities, that we need these prescriptions, that we need this for our quality of life, for us to stay alive longer. So that's why it's so important for, like, how we all are able to come together in all of our smaller communities, make one kind of big rare disease community to advocate and help support each other.
I just hope this little interview rings a few bells. There's so much more information that needs to go out so people are aware. It's a process. And I do understand, if you've got a rare disease, 1 out of 7,000 and only 300 people have it, it's a tough undertaking for, a drug company to try to work on that.
Yeah.
The converse of that sort of is when we were hit with the pandemic, we didn't know much about it, but it took about a year to come up with the vaccine. And I go back because I'm old. Well, let me say I'm older. I don't like to use the word old, but I go back to when we had polio, and it took them years and maybe decades to come up with a polio vaccine. Finally, President Roosevelt had polio, and that's in the 40s. And, in the 50s, they came up with a polio vaccine. But I mean, that was decades of working on that. And now COVID hits, and within a year, they come up with using RNA, doing something with the genetic structure of the COVID virus. But that was a year, pretty fast.
Yeah, and that's something that's, especially now in terms of our medical knowledge and technology, is it's evolving so quickly and so fast comparatively. And like, I was born in 1999. If I was born in 1997, I'd say it's very unlikely that I live. They didn't really have the technology to really do all the things that they could do at the time. At the time in 1999. And that's kind of how it's like always evolving. And right now too, I'm in a weird spot where I always had pediatric doctors, but doctors that, are not pediatric doctors don't know my condition because no one prior lived this long. So I still have to work with pediatric doctors because they're the only ones that know my condition. And that's something that I'm going to have to do the rest of my life until every other doctor is able to catch up.
Wow. Wow. We were just talking about this. We're talking about the vaccines, but it takes the our FDA roughly 15 years to approve a new drug. Yeah. A lot of years, and it took them, I don't know, months to approve a vaccine. I'm trying to process that.
It's hard, especially when it's something where they're able to designate so much time with like the COVID vaccine. There was so much time that it was a high priority. It was something that affected the globe. Regardless of how healthy you were prior to March 2020, you could still be negatively affected either by COVID or post-COVID symptoms, long COVID, whatever have you. So it was this vital investment. They put all the money into it, but like the process to get things done, all the phase trials, all the clinical trials, everything. It's such a long process. And if one little thing goes wrong, the whole process starts over.
Starts over again. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Just to take a breather, just to go off topic for a second, the disclaimer is you don't have to answer this question. You can. It's a cute question. You can give a one-word answer or a couple-word answer. But here's the situation. Excluding family or friends, somebody living or dead you'd like to spend a day with.
Yeah, think about that.
Think about it. You don't have to answer.
I'm trying to think about that. I'd say probably one of we had one of the most important rare disease advocates. I never had the pleasure of meeting them before they passed, sadly. But Claire Wineland was probably my inspiration to getting involved with rare disease advocacy and policy.
Okay.
She was someone that spoke a lot about, especially it was a lot about self-advocacy. And not waiting until you're healthy to help change the world and do what's right and fight for yourself and the representation of who you are as a disabled person. I think that's something that's really incredible.
Well, okay. Great answer. Moving along, in your tagline on LinkedIn, you You've made presentations, and I just think this is great, at MIT and Harvard, in Rare Disease Week on Capitol Hill. You want to just talk about any of that stuff? I mean, MIT and Harvard.
So talking about when I was at Harvard Medical School and MIT, it was a lot about the importance of rare disease advocacy and legislation, and why, especially as young upcoming adults with rare disease and conditions, it is important for us to advocate not only policy-wise, but for ourselves in doctor's appointments, in life in general, at home. There's so many ways that you can be an advocate as a rare disease patient, and you need to be able to have your voice heard and known and understood. And I think that's something that I always wanted to push, and I'm so glad I had those two opportunities at MIT and Harvard. And then when it comes to the idea of the Rare Disease Week on Capitol Hill, we were all there advocating for policies to be passed. This was, funny enough, it was like 2 weeks before the pandemic, like lockdowns began.
Oh, so wow.
Like February of 2020. So this was like 2-3 weeks before, and thankfully none of us got COVID from that, but it was so impactful to be able to talk about being on that platform on a stage where there's so many of my peers there, being able to talk about the importance of our young adult legislation and being able to be involved right now and how to make our elevator pitches and our talks to our Senate House members the most effective that we can be. And talking about that is so, so amazing. I was so thankful.
That is an amazing thing on your resume to have been there, you know, at MIT and Harvard. Just, that's just great stuff. So you do some internship, and I've been reading and checking out, and actually I actually signed up to Every Life to get their emails and updates. So it's part of my awareness process. So I get all these emails and stuff from them. But can you talk a little bit about Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases?
Yeah, so it's this organization that is able to kind of bring all of the community together, the rare disease community, and advocate for policy. It keeps my job as an intern, for example, I wrote a lot of, there's a thing, legislative scorecards, which goes through every state in alphabetical order, all the House, Senate members, what bills they're supporting, what bills they're not supporting. Goes over how like certain state policies, so for example, newborn screening was a federal policy, fortunately expired and has not been renewed. And it's showing every state's overall grade in terms of how the newborn screening is going in each state. I was responsible for writing the newsletters during those times. So I was updating any state or federal policy that was happening, keeping people up to date, knowledgeable what was going on. And then Rare Across America was happening during that time, and I helped organize that. So it was basically, it's kind of Rare Disease Week on Capitol Hill, except it's in district. So going to all the house, like all the people that live in those certain districts would meet the House member there or meet their senator overall in the state, or a staffer in those areas. And it was helping organize, get people mobilized, get people signed up, let people know when their meetings were, if they needed any help, either on like the public speaking side or the policy side. And then also during the meetings, I was like, I was a moderator that was there if they needed help gearing the conversations or if anyone needed some extra support or anything like that. So overall, I think it's awesome that we're able to mobilize so many people and get them involved in all 50 states, every territory in the United States. It's really important and impactful, and it's good that we're able to, again, regardless of where you are, right, age, gender, race, whatever have you, we're all able to come together under this one shared issue that we're all having.
And there's enough of you out there. There's 30 million of you out there.
Yeah.
So moving along, and this is one of the highlights of our little chat. You've written a book called Disposed, A Story of Chronic Illness During the COVID-19 Pandemic. And I hold up what it looks like. Let's talk about that. And you're also going to send me a link where people can get this book, and I'll be promoting the link and the book, and I'm going to grab a copy myself. So talk about why you wrote it, and what does it really talk about, and obviously it's going to talk about your experiences with your rare condition.
Yeah, so I during from the first year of COVID was probably the toughest time of my life, and it was a crazy experience, especially as someone who is incredibly high risk. And it was difficult, so difficult. I'm still trying to still processing what exactly I went through. It was a very traumatic time, very isolating time, very difficult time, just being alive and experiencing all these things and seeing all of what was happening around the world as well. And once I was able to be vaccinated and kind of be more around people, talking to a lot of people in the rare disease community too, there was this like collective pain that we all kind of had, this isolation that still people were still experiencing as well, because they were also having their own struggles and having their own problems, either in the past or still continuing. And I remember I was trying to apply to grad school, and I was talking to one of the admissions persons. They asked like my story, and I told them what I was doing the last year and was open and honest about everything. And they said that I should write a book about it. And I was joking with my coworker the next day, and she said that if I wrote the first 10 pages, she would proofread it. So I said, okay. And it kind of just went from there. I started writing it in November of 2021. I finished in February. And from there I published. And the main reason I wanted to continue the project was because I wanted to show other people in the rare disease community they weren't alone, but also to show a new perspective to a lot of people that never really considered the rare disease side or the disabled side or the sick side, because there's been so many comments like from throughout the whole pandemic where it was like the idea very early on, like, oh, only the old and sick are dying. Or when people didn't want lockdowns anymore, they say, oh, you can stay inside or return to our lives, like as if our lives didn't mean as much. And it's difficult, especially when there is still a lot of ableist rhetoric and a lot of anti-vax rhetoric. And it's important to get this type of message out.
It's so interesting to me, the sociology involved. People have had their time with COVID and all the restrictions. And when they began to loosen the restrictions, I just read a ton of stuff online. And yes, you have all these deniers, and you're going to always have that. That's just part of societal. But it's funny, when they began to relax a year ago, I went to a concert, not a music concert. I went to another kind of concert. I won't get too graphic. There were 250 people there. I went because I was very close to the entertainer, and I wanted to show a sense of loyalty to the entertainer. So I agreed to go. Actually, I was kind of reluctant to go, putting myself, in those close environments. But anyway, I went, and this was sociologically so interesting to me. We're right in the middle of the pandemic. They were easing things up, but we're still there. And there were 250 people in the audience, and there's only one person wearing a mask.
Yeah, and that's something still where when I got COVID for the first time in April of 2022, first and only time, thankfully. But my condition, it was so bad when I was vaccinated and double boosted that I'm fairly convinced that if I was unvaccinated or I had gotten it in 2020, that very likely chance I could have died. And it's something where I think it's very, people are just cavalier about the fact that COVID is here now. And it's something that's very disappointing, where there's times too where I feel, there's certain times where I feel very comfortable going out, but I wear my mask. And right. There's other times, even if it's like a small event and I'm I'm going to be wearing my mask. I just don't feel comfortable and I don't want to go there. And it's just, it's still difficult to try and feel comfortable and safe, especially with how relaxed people seem.
Correct. You know, a few weeks ago, I went to, you know, my Rutgers. I went to a Rutgers basketball game at Jersey Mike's Arena. I call it as I see it. And I did get COVID. It was brought into my house. So my whole house had it. My grandkids, we were all living here. But the point being, so I went to the Rutgers Athletic Center. There were 8,000 people there for the Rutgers Columbia game. I wore my mask. Actually, it was a cloth mask. I doubled up. I'm not, because I'm semi crazy, a little OCD. I doubled up, but I also looked around. I was trying to find how many other masks were in that 8,000-seat arena, and I saw three, best I could find, with three other people who are wearing a mask. I didn't see any in the student section wearing a mask. Whatever. It is what it is. So we've come to the beginning of doing some stuff with you and continuing this. This was stage one. I don't even know if I mentioned, I'm just kind of doing a wrap here. I'm trying to remember if I thanked Yashi.
You did.
I did. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for, yeah, that was so important to me because she was, she got us together and started me on a journey. So anyway, Dan, I can't thank you enough for doing this, for giving of yourself and being so open and actually kind of lighting my fire a little bit. That's an old song from the 60s, Jim Morrison, Light My Fire. And you have lit my fire because I was, like I said, I thought I knew and I don't, and others need to know. So I'm officially inviting you back to come back in any shape, way or form. You know, we could do panels and discuss anything. I'm loyal and I'm here for you. And really, I just want to thank you so much for this.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was such a pleasure to be able to be here and talk about rare disease policy, the importance of it. And I really appreciate you having this platform.
Perfect. So happy and healthy, and that's a powerful word. Happy, healthy holidays, all good things. And I love to say this is to be continued. So thank you. Don't leave. I'm just stopping the recording.
Yep.
Thanks, Dan.